Welcome to a podcast on Fire Network bonus episode on In the Line of Duty 4 and First Option. It's done, but we're still here. So after performing our legislative duty of looking at 9 films with and from Michael Wong, remember he did direct one, we thought we'd kick back with a bonus episode, actually 2 episodes, discussing movies that weren't picked for the Wong or Wrong coverage. I mean, he's officially Wong. We like him, and I knew I would. But it needs to be done. Like it needs to be go through the legal process, and we did. So these particular reviews that's coming up in the bonus episodes, they are not in need of having an assigned Wong or Wrong grade to them. They are, at any rate, In the Line of Duty 4, that features Michael alongside the daredevil and ass-kicking duo of Cynthia Khan and Donnie Yen. And we'll also be looking at First Option from 1996, which extends Michael's comfort and familiarity in the SDU role and genre of movies, really. But regardless, I'm Kenny B, and with me still for this website exclusive bonus episode, meaning you can't get it on Apple Podcasts or other podcatchers, is Phil G of Eastern Film Fans. Hello.
Hello. Ah, it's like we've never been away.
We've been here a very, very long time. For yeah. many hours, hours during the main coverage, and now we're still here.
And we're still here with bonus time.
We have impressive pipes. We can speak this for this long and like uninterrupted. So
we love to talk.
That's what seasoned podcasters do. They tend to their pipes off air to make sure we can speak for days
on it. Yeah.
The bonus episode is very simple. It's very direct. We thought we'd include these. I wasn't conflicted necessarily. Like, I must fit them in somehow. Because in the Line of Duty 4, yeah, fine. But we got the 80s lineup. It's Legacy of Rage and Royal Warriors. And then I want to do a cut to some other key moments in the 90s. To be fair, Royal Warriors is kind of lumped into the In the Line of Duty series anyway, as I'll tell you in a bit. And with First Option, well, we did Final Option, which is the first role, his first SDU role, the one he sort of got famous for, and this is the second film. So that's why we didn't do a double bill of those. But we have an announcement for the third movie in the second bonus episode that I probably was conflicted about. That I need to get it in there somehow, this particular movie. It's so daft. And we need to get it in there. But ultimately, I had to make a hard executive decision. But it's been honored in the bonus format. We'll announce that movie at the end of the show or when you listen to the bonus episode that covers that film. So let's get into it. In the Line of Duty 4 from 1989, I believe. I've written the wrong damn year in my notes, but my brain is working. So it is from 1989. A plot from Hong Kong Digital's review of the film. Honest Seattle dock worker Luk Wan Ting, played by Yun Yat Cho, accidentally gets himself involved in America's drug wars when he stumbles into a shootout and is blamed for the death of a DEA operative. He flees to Hong Kong with Inspector Jung, played by Cynthia Khan, and Officers Donnie, played by Donnie Yen, and Michael, lo and behold, played by Michael Wong, in pursuit. She wasn't named Cynthia, at the very least. They were creative with her name, at the very least, because she's the star of the series.
Yeah, but that was the creativity. That was in the morning, wasn't it? And they thought Jung. And then by that time, it was edging into the afternoon, and they couldn't come up with anything else. And obviously, T was approaching, so they just went, Donnie, yeah, let's go to Michael. Yeah, let's do that. All right. See
the tomorrow, star of the series receives the utmost dose of creativity. And that is Cynthia Khan. They apprehend Luke, the police officers, and plan to extradite him to America, but he is shot and must be hospitalized. While the criminals make further attempts on his life, Madame Jung and Donnie become increasingly suspicious of Michael, whose actions suggest that he is undermining their efforts. So, a little bit of background. We haven't examined the series in full, you know, the female-led cop action series that got to be known as In the Line of Duty. And we're here at the fourth installment, as I said. And I gather, I've seen most, but maybe not four out of seven, I think I've seen, right? But I gather none really got any story connective tissue, only recurring cast. But it came a bit of a retroactive title as the official timeline. I always dread that I'm not getting this right, but I'm hoping I get this right. So the official timeline for the In the Line of Duty series of films leading up to 4 would be Royal Warriors with Michelle Yeoh and Michael Wong, released in 1986. The 1985 movie Yes, Madam, starring Michelle Yeoh and Cynthia Rothrock, got to be In the Line of Duty 2 in some sort of also known as sort of a release mystery thing. Then there was the third entry, In the Line of Duty 3, the first of the films to carry that title in Hong Kong, that introduced Cynthia Khan to the series. And here we are with 1989's In the Line of Duty 4 with Cynthia Khan, Donnie Yen, and Michael Wong. And then Cynthia Khan stuck with the Madam or Inspector Jung part in the following order. So what we had then was for the fifth entry, it was called Middleman. And then the sixth entry was called Forbidden Arsenal. And the quote-unquote seventh In the Line of Duty film was called Seawolves. That one I don't think I've seen. I've seen Middleman fairly recently. And Forbidden Arsenal super long ago, so I don't remember too much. The 1991 movie Queen's High apparently also got tagged with a In the Line of Duty The Beginning. But I'm not sure Cynthia even played a policewoman. I don't remember simply. Or became one at the end of it, because it's been a while. The image of her mowing down bad guys with an Uzi in her wedding dress, that's more memorable, and that should be more memorable. So I don't really have any, if she was a civilian or if she actually was a cop in that movie, doesn't really matter, because that movie is worth watching for that scene alone. But it's a good early 90s actioner with Cynthia Khan. It really doesn't matter, right, which order you see these in. Regardless, I don't know if you've seen all of them or if you're like missing Seawolves.
Yeah, I vaguely remember some of them better than others. That towards the back end, not so much. Forbidden Arsenal and the Seawolves, I don't recall as much as the others, which obviously I've seen quite a bit of.
I haven't seen the third one, which was her debut, so I don't know if that is super highly regarded versus, you know, great entries like Royal Warriors, Yes, Madam, and In the Line of Duty 4. So I don't know how 3 fares in the eyes of the fans, necessarily.
I think 3 stands up and stands on its own. It's a cracking film, but what you take from it, it's title only for these films. There are people that are in these films that are different characters. They die in other films and then come back as somebody else in the next film. These are the things they do, and it's a shame really, because it's great, but it drew people to see these films just by the tagline In the Line of Duty. Oh, there's another one, I need to see that. And nobody really cared that they weren't connected. I think in today's age I'd be like, well, that's not connected, that isn't right, my God. But you know, then no, it was just, oh God, another one in the series of, you know, cop films. You know, Cynthia's in it now, and she was running it, and you know, they did really well. To be fair, she did really well in that role. She kind of grew into it, so to speak, and both from an action point of view and an acting point of view. I think
I like Middleman a lot, actually. And one highlight of that is her versus Kim Marie Penn fighting with swords, samurai swords. So it's like it also has nods to traditional stuff, but it was really a solid thriller as well, Middleman. And by that point, I think then the quality sort of became like, yeah, it's possible 90s fare, reduced budgets and so forth. I'll at one point I'll pick up at the very least 3 to sort of fill in the gap, and because I'm curious to see how much of an impression she did in that one. If you had not seen Cynthia Khan in the series before turning on In the Line of Duty 4, it's a great intro as well, because that lady is both talented and brave and game.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm wondering how much she pushed herself, or they pushed her in the Line of Duty 3. So I need to track that down. This movie, the fourth entry, was directed by Yuen Woo-ping, who was on a streak of modern actioners after having done, obviously, kung fu comedies and other things. He started this sort of streak with Tiger Cage, and he did 2 additional entries in the Tiger Cage series, with Donnie Yen being in 1 and 2 and Michael Wong taking the lead in Tiger Cage 3. I haven't seen that, actually. I have very little memory of the two I have seen, one and two. So I'm looking forward to re-examining Yuen Ping's take on modern action, like that transition and how he flexes his sort of narrative and action muscles.
Really, really good. So I love the Tiger. I even like three, which was less on the action, but there was and Donnie again. We'll get onto it, but there's some absolute classic scenes in it. But
I remember Tiger Cage 2 not faring very, very well as a comedy, but very good as an action film.
Oh, as an action film, it's up there. It's really solid here.
But the Yun said had an eventful 80s. The Yun clan, the Yun brothers, with martial arts classics, of course. Magnificent Butcher, Buddhist Fist. Buddhist Fist might have been 79 or 80, regardless, it's around that time. Dreadnought, of course. But then they also did sort of wacky, induced by a haze of sorts, supernatural romps like Miracle Fighters and Shaolin Drunk God. I love those movies. And then you cap it all off with breakdancing comedy in mismatched couples. I'm not being cheeky. It's still my favorite Donnie Yen movie. I think he's great in it.
You love that.
Because everybody are in that movie they're in it to win it.
It might have been my first introduction to Donnie Yen, you know, I don't know. I have a vague recollection of going, oh, this kid's good. And I'm sure it was Mismatched Couples. I really do, which is kind of a bizarre introduction into the world of Donnie Yen, because it was just bizarre. But
it wasn't Drunken Tai Chi. That was your introduction by any chance, or that was later on?
Actually, no, yeah. See, and you're right. It was one of those two. It was either I watched Drunken Tai Chi and then it was Mismatched Couples, or... Yeah, I think it probably was Drunken Tai Chi, actually.
Which is not necessarily traditional, but I believe that was pretty wacky and out there as well, Drunken Tai Chi.
It was a little bit and stuff, but obviously all of a sudden I thought, oh, this looks good. This is interesting. This guy looks good. So yeah, I think it was a little bit. I think probably one of those two at the time kind of introduced me to it. So yeah, it wasn't the hardcore stuff that we later introduced, or become more from a fan base kind of thing, renowned for, but these quirky kind of films.
They really should be upgraded and re-released and just exploit the Ip Man name, for heaven's sake. Just slap from the star and director, not director, but action director of Ip Man in the biggest fucking letters you can think of. But just put Drunken Tai Chi and Mishmash Couples in like a two-pack, and I'll buy two copies and give to friends. Several copies and give to friends. Like, you gotta watch it.
I mean, that'd be crazy fun. Crazy fun to do. Talk about. I mean, they're great films. But Donnie Yen should sell those kind of films. I mean, people should be picking those up now and stuff. They're missing out on a treat. And they do well. They'd sell well. Donnie Yen is a name as well. So, but we'll see.
That transition I talked of is for Yuen Woo-ping from traditional to modern. It's quite interesting to watch for people like him, for people like Lau Ga-leung. They put some things from traditional to apply to the modern action genre and that working method. But also, you need to require, you're required to develop a new set of tools. And I think Lau Ga-leung did very well with Tiger on Beat and Dragon Family, pulling. I mean, he was action director really on that one, but it's very much him and his style on that one. In The Line of Duty, I think could be argued to be a little bit more comfortable territory for Yuen Woo-ping, because it is very martial arts oriented. It isn't solely heroic bloodshed or anything. So I think it's a mix of what they're comfortable with and some very new ideas to execute as well. And that film, In the Line of Duty 4, grossed a little over 12 million Hong Kong dollars, which was about 5 million more than its predecessor, Sinfia Khan's debut in the series. That was out the previous year. And out of the numbers I have for the series, I don't have all. This was the most successful. Middleman, for instance, made about 6 million the next year, so the numbers dropped. We know why that is. No, Michael. I have no list for the 1989 box office, no total, like top 10 list or top 20, where In the Line of Duty 4 was positioned with its 12 million, but it was trailing big hits that year, such as Wong Jing's God of Gamblers at 37 million. The Johnny To Chiang Fat melodrama All About Ah Long made 30 million. John Woo's The Killer made 18 million. And the Yuen Biu star of The Iceman Cometh made 14 million. And then you had In the Line of Duty 4 at 12. So I'm guessing a top 20 film is feasible. And that a series keeps increasing its earnings is a good thing. So as for short opinions, therefore, off In the Line of Duty 4, for me, I've seen it before many years ago. It's a light film and that does what it says on the tin. And it's a snappy 90 minutes of steady stream of action, tolerable narrative in between. Thankfully, never sinks to comedic lows and maintain its action thriller narrative because of it. But with light, I mean, this is easy. This is comforting. And this is also pretty decent confirmation that Yuen Woo-ping wasn't out of his element, making modern martial arts, and even when dipping into gunplay and darker violence, he was pretty good at it. And variation, momentum, and such elements stood out during this rewatch in particular. I thought, like, even when we think we're tired of action scenes, we get another one, but it offers up something new and fresh. So the movie is good at that. So I like it. I like it very much, as a matter of fact. So as for your short opinion, this rewatch for you.
Yeah, it's one of the stable action movies go to when you just want, I think, as you say, there's a very thin story to it, but the action's just comes like thick and fast. It's great. You can just put on and you can zone in and out and just be and just enjoy what's going on. From an action point of view, it's a wonderful film, and it holds up really well today. Like I say, it is thin plot wise, but you know we don't really care when you're watching this kind of film because you're there to see the action, and that's where this film still stands the test of time, I think. So yeah, I really enjoyed it again.
I know you don't think so, but I'm going to ask it anyway to sort of provide context for the discussion. Too much action, or there is no such thing as too much when you're varying it up, as Yuen Woo-ping is?
Yeah, there isn't exactly that, the latter. If you're varying it up, then it doesn't get bored and stale, and you can throw in as many as he does because in this case, it like I say, you never get bored of it because of the diversity of it. So, yeah.
Yeah, very much. I've seen so many Hong Kong movies, so I know the telltale signs of when something isn't going good. And it made me chuckle that the cheap opening credits where it's just shots of harbor and the skyline and cheap music and all of that either suggests like low budget nonsense or a movie that's very direct, yeah, meaning that let's get the credits over with and let's get going, and they certainly do. We might as well mention before we get going, because we're gonna talk of Cynthia Khan, she was actually Taiwanese, and I wanted to look up what her background was because I wasn't sure, and she studied jazz dance. She wasn't a ballet dancer like Michelle Yeoh, but over the course of her life she learned Taekwondo and increased her ranking in Taekwondo, and her name apparently is this not very inspired conception of like what's the persona we're going to create using her name. Well, think of Cynthia Rothrock, think of Michelle Yeoh, that was once known as Michelle Khan, and then combine it. Ta-da! Star in the making. Yeah. Cynthia Khan it is. Her name is Yang Li Tsing. Otherwise, that's her actual name, if you will. Thank God she was good. Because otherwise, that is just commercial powers trying to squeeze a star out of someone who wasn't ready for it, by combining names of stars that were ready for it and who went far. But thankfully, Cynthia Khan, she took on that challenge and then some. Before we get going, I also want to say, because he's in this movie a little bit, at the time of recording, we just lost character actor Liu Kai-chi, who plays Yun Ya-chor's friend Ming, the gambling debt-ridden flatmate of his. And he had stomach cancer and died at 66, not too long ago at the time of recording. Very dependable, but also over the top, but also amazing character actor. He was a two-time Hong Kong Film Award winner for the ensemble drama Cage Man, which is woefully underrepresented on available Hong Kong video. I mean, I have the Laserdisc and VCD, but that's not good enough for a movie like that. But he also won the Best Supporting Actor Award for Beast Stalker, 2008-09's Beast Stalker. It's very cool to see him here looking very young and participating in the action. let's do some highlights as we start here. There's a decent fight in here at the beginning with Yun Yacho. I think he has a crowbar and has to take on several henchmen coming at him from all sides. And the scene also involved like a fun little nunchuck visual gag consisting of big wrenches, which is this nod to traditional. And if you think about it, Phil, the first 15 minutes, I think, has three or four fight scenes.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
I mean, it never worrisome for you that they're that fast out of the gate and they're stacking fight scenes?
No, I love it. I love it. I love the fact that, well, once again, you got Eddie Mayer fronting the gang that was coming. And Eddie Mayer with large spanners again. Look it up. We did this on another podcast. But what is with Eddie Mayer with massive spanners? Anyway.
Yeah, well, what's that other movie? I have that image in my head now. What was that other movie?
I was going to say a knockoff, but I think it was quite recently we watched it and he had this massive spanner. He was only in it for a brief scene as well. And he was great, but you know what you're going
to
get.
It's Royal Warriors. Henry Sonata goes to him to buy guns, and then there's a fight scene on a ship.
That's it, and he has to buy guns, and he has a mass. So I don't know what it is, any man with massive spanners, but I did chortle when I saw it and thought, oh, yes, that was it. But it was great, and you know you're in for a treat, and it's a nice put-together little scene and stuff. And Cynthia just kind of stands on the sidelines and lets them get on with it and stuff, and then has a little, as you say, improvised nunchucks, which is great, and a little introduction right at the start. And like I say, it just flows into from one fight scene to next, but it's nice that you go, okay, here we go. This is what we're going to get. It sets the movie up nicely, and, you know, off we go.
Yeah, it sort of concludes that sequence, I think, with that incredibly high jump for the stuntman from a height into the harbor. I think they're in America by this point. The movie is set in Seattle. I could not determine if it was shot in Seattle. The ending credits didn't thank any, like, Seattle Police, Seattle Harbor Authority, blah, blah, blah. So I'm not sure it was shot in Seattle, but certainly they did shoot in America. And whoever did that jump, my stomach turned a little bit because he just keeps going and going and going. The water is not getting near him anytime soon. Finally, he hits the damn water, you know. And probably into dirty harbor water as well.
Exactly.
But I don't mind it either because it's there's fun variation on screen. The plot isn't stalled. They don't sink to comedy for 10-15 minutes with a character like Liu Kaichi's, which could have been like the comedic target for a director. Like, that's the guy that we want the audience to laugh at for a couple of sections here while we pad this to 90 minutes. But the movie never has that problem. Speaking of Michael's introduction, you know, think of his Royal Warriors dorkiness and horniness and childishness to this slick 1989 version of an adult Michael smoking and looking cool, but not dubbed by himself, obviously. His dubber is so not him. The voice is nothing like his, but he looks a little bit more slick. For like 1986, 1989 year difference makes a difference. But he gets a less disturbing character, I suppose, in this one.
Sugary with a big bouffanty hairdo. But, you know, that's Michael for you.
But even, you know, Yun Yacho as the lead here, he was asked to be the comedic lead in other Yuen Woo-ping traditional martial arts movies. And that was never an easy proposition for me, but here he isn't. And he actually is a little bit of an acting standout. He's the physically skilled everyday man drawn into these circumstances. And to be honest, you're used to him being part of the Yuen clan and doing all kinds of kick-ass things and being comedic and being part of some very strange content. But for me, Phil, this is a good look for Yun Yacho as the everyday man who clearly doesn't want to be here, and everybody, they're after him and hard.
Yeah, I think I remember seeing this in, wow, I don't recall him in other things, and I know he was briefly in films when I look back, and I was like, wow, and I don't think he did anything after this film either that I recall. So it was kind of like, okay, kind of like back catalogue of stuff, thought, yeah, he's actually got it. And you're right, he could have been kind of the brunt of it, but he's got some skills on him, I'll give him that, and he's got a presence to him. I quite enjoyed him.
Yeah, his physicality, meaning that he can't take care of himself, that isn't I think a forced notion. That is, he can stand up in fights, but he's still helpless in a way. I think that works. I mean, they're after him in unexpected places. You know, assassinations turn up left or right in police stations during interrogation and all of that. So, but at the same time, you know, that logic of, well, he's clearly capable physically, so he shouldn't be afraid, versus that the narrative dictates that he is afraid and this is dangerous. That works because it's a mixture of action, thriller, martial arts narrative. So you can accept those mix of good physical skills, but mental fear, I suppose. The brutality of the film, I don't know if you had any comment on that. Yuen Woo-ping isn't just doing fun action scenes, but there is a number of, violent deaths and a sort of pessimistic narrative where there's, as I said, assassinations around every corner. And if you remember Tiger Cage, I think he was pushing some brutal buttons in that one. So is that, you know, preferable for you within an action film to be this pessimistic?
Yeah, I like it because it adds a sense of realism to some extent and danger to it. It just amps it up. It just gives the film you're moving out of the PG-13 territory, aren't you? And then all of a sudden it adds the danger to it as well, which is always nice, and adds an element of, as I say, the danger to the film. And you don't know, like, who's going to survive in the film, who isn't, and are they going to have a bloody death? And I like the beats of violent in a film. It just keeps you on your toes to a certain extent.
Yeah, very much agree. And it also adds to that variation as well, that, yes, we have a lot of action scenes, but we have a lot of scenes favoring the thriller aspect, and therefore, yeah, you know, you're going to have executions and a little bit of gunplay. And what you're also going to have, and it made me laugh, and I don't think it was intentional necessarily, Donnie Yen as this hothead cop. Boy, is he angry. Boy, is he pissed all the time in this movie. You know what? He's developed nicely as an actor at some points when he's trying to be the bad cop, the angry cop that's going to smash confessions out of bad guys, or Yun Ya-cho. I'm sorry, it did make me laugh because I don't think he's really, really there as an actor.
He wasn't. His opening scene is... you can see the acting capability, even Michael kind of out-acts him. And by Dan, I think Donnie Yen is saying he was growing into being an actor, but what he does do from a physicality point of view, and his opening introduction with the jump spinning back kick against the guys, is just like, wow. Mm-hmm. That's what people didn't care that he couldn't act, because, you know, as soon as he does those kicks and stuff, everybody goes, oh my God, wow, look at that. And that's what they see Donnie in. And they didn't really, and you don't really focus on his acting, which is, you know, it isn't anywhere near where he is today. And people still poo-poo it, but he evolved and it took him time, his acting.
Because you know why it was funny as well? Because he's such an asshole. Calm your ass down.
He plays a proper, yeah. But he's a proper dick, to be honest. It's like, oh God. So you don't really like him anyway, because he comes off as a bit of a dick. And what, you know, what, why are you beating up the, you know, the star, you know, star witness? What are you being a cock for, Donnie? But, you know, you forgive him because he's got great kicks on him. So it's one of those. But yeah.
You know, did you notice the moment where they're with Yun Ya-cho's mother, played by Lisa Chow from the One-Armed Swordsman movies? At one point, he lights a cigarette and puts it out on Yun Ya-cho's mother's floor. Respect your elders. I'm an asshole.
Well, yeah, like I say, he's not a very bit likable character. He comes around towards the end of it, but it's too late by then. He still comes across as a bit of a cop. He's doing his best to act, but even, you know, Cynthia Khan acts him in this. I mean, that's why he got a bad rap, but like I say, you can't take anything.
You know, the contrasts are there for a reason. I think, she's the reasonable policewoman, and he's the not so reasonable male cop. So I certainly get the structure, but you're right. She is out-acting him and really outdoing him in action scenes at points as well. But they're not giving the same action scenes because they're structuring them around their respective skill sets. And before we get to the van scene that I'm sure you have some notes on, I do want to say that there is really a snap to this, and it moves so quickly and through each beat, but it isn't just stacking action scenes and then forgetting about the basic narrative. That is there. We understand he's in trouble, and because he's in trouble, we're gonna stack the action scenes, but also provide as much variation as we can, both fight scenes, gunplay, and Daredevil stunt scenes. And what are your notes on the fight scene on top of the van and Cynthia Khan really almost outdoing Jackie Chan in Police Story in certain shots? So.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, isn't it? I remember Donnie in an interview saying, obviously, Yuen Woo-ping, you know, just Khan was up for anything. She wasn't the, you know, the greatest, you know, martial artist or anything else. Obviously, she's got that dance background and stuff, but she was fearless. She was fearless. She'd do anything, and that was the thing. And I think, obviously, Yuen Woo-ping loved the fact that she would do that, and obviously with a lot of training, a lot of coach, you know, she'd do all these stunts. It was pretty amazing. I mean, it's a great scene, and you can see her doing some of this stuff, and, you know, you need some balls on you to do that, and she got a pair, and that's what drove her, I think, to, you know, have the career that she did and stuff, because she was fearless. It was great to see.
The funny thing is, when that sequence starts off as their you know, junior choice in the ambulance, but I think it's John Salvini is he's one of the persons that take over the ambulance in a very smooth sort of heist manner. And when they start off fighting on the top of the van, there's some select doubling, and it looks safe enough. And then they do stuff that you really can't fake other than just hang on for dear life or just strap the actress to the van.
Strapped to the vehicle, yeah. Unbelievable.
It's jaw-dropping as, you know, in some shots it's her obviously wired up to some degree, I hope, but still looks like she's hanging on for dear life, obviously mixed with stunt persons. That she fights, but also replaces her in some shots. But then, you know, rolling off the hood and then making sure she don't fall off the car and then hanging onto the grate of the car with the legs under the car or van while driving. Obviously, she's strapped in, but it's mighty impressive because it doesn't look like they're on this flatbed. They're not. You can see they're not. And it's the standout sequence in the film for me. The movie has several highlights along the way, but this was jaw-dropping still, and she did such a phenomenal job. And if she potentially didn't have any similar scenes in the Line of Duty 3, but I'm gonna find out eventually, that would mean that she upped her game and upped the ante for in the Line of Duty 4. I can do more. You know, hold my beer, strap me to the car.
Absolutely. I'd like to say it is phenomenal when you see it, and you take it for granted sometimes when you watch these films the first time and go, yeah, she's doing that and stuff. But no, yes, she's doing that. You know, you got to appreciate that she's putting herself out there and doing those stunts. There's, you know, there is, like you say, a little bit of doubling it. But there's some scenes there that you can see her. It is her doing that. I mean, that, like I say, that is fearless. I mean, that is really just to be commended, to be honest.
I mentioned that I think he's transitioning into becoming a more comfortable actor. And can you spot that personally with Michael Wong 3 years after Royal Warriors awkwardness and horniness for you?
Yeah, I think so. I think we talked about this. I think there's definitely an evolution with Michael Wong from an acting point of view. And he definitely hits his stride. To certain, and he's better in certain films as well, depending on the character he plays, and he can broaden his acting capabilities. But yeah, you can definitely see a difference in the level of acting and what he can do from obviously previous films. And I like I say, I think that's an evolution. But I also think sometimes it's the obviously the films that he's probably given.
I mean, even later in his career, I saw Overheard One not too long ago. He gives it his all, but it's a terrible performance. It's a legendary performance, but it's a terrible performance, really. But he gives it his all. Yeah. It's the he plays a bad guy in Overheard, some sort of corporate something, you know, upstanding person in society, but he is the bad guy. And he has, like, crazy lines when he's arrested at the end of the movie, screaming to everybody, "I have my own car!" You know, he doesn't want to go into to a police van or car. But even, you know, in depending on the recent movie, there might be a better comfort there, and I can see a nice comfort here responding to the basic material. You know, he does play a villain in the movie, so he got some nice glare, and of course his the bad guy glare without being over the top. But it's also decent fun when his character is part of the action beats, so it makes it a little bit more dynamic to see him take part in these action scenes that are mixed with stunt doubles. But there are some admirable exchanges. I think he looks pretty good with the brief sword exchanges with both Donnie Yen and both Cynthia Khan. And so that's the sort of new side to 80s Michael Wong, that he takes part in this particular action choreography, and not just shooting guns, but a little bit of this, and then some select skillful doubling in between, and you got yourself a Michael Wong martial arts performance for a little bit, anyway.
Yeah, a little bit. He tries. I mean, like you say, he gets away with it to a certain extent. I mean, Donnie Yen, you can just see, obviously, from a physical acting point of view, you know, Donnie's like leaps and bounds ahead. But, you know, at that point in time, probably Michael Wong, from an acting point of view, yeah, was probably leaps and bounds in front of Donnie. So, but, you know, it works well.
Any highlights from the Western cast that's brought in here? And I gather that the main Westerners that people remember from these movies are Donnie's friends, John Salvetti and Michael Woods.
Okay, let's do John Salvetti first, because the fight scene in the alley when he knocks him off the bike and he jumps off and hits him and stuff is just, it's pure delight, and probably lots of people's favourite fight scene in the film, because he just breaks, Donnie breaks into, you know, kind of Muhammad Ali, you know, boxing, and it was fresh as well. This is a fight scene, we hadn't seen that kind of thing before. Certainly when I watched it, I remember it going, wow, Donnie Yen. I think that's when he all of a sudden was like, whoa, this guy's great, I need to see everything in him, because all of a sudden he was doing something we hadn't seen. He kind of mixes boxing with it, and he was quick and fast, and he looked so great on screen. And it was a fairly short exchange and stuff, but by God, did it look good. It would, you know, that was like, that was the moment for me. I went, Donnie Yen, wow, this guy's got some moves. I want to see what else he can do. So I think that exchange was wonderful and possibly my favorite.
And it has been preceded by a fairly skilled bike stunts and that kind of design as well. And then when they're done with that, they transition into this. And it's very entertaining that they build upon one type of action design and then move into this. Bless John, he's also in it to win it. He is a Hong Kong action cinema Western bad guy, you know, cranked up to 11, and it's very enjoyable to watch.
Absolute balmy crazy. And you're right, the other Brit, well, there's really good stunt scene with the bikes, etc. and stuff, and Stephen Berwick's in that piece where Donnie Yen does this jump back kick and knocks him off the bike. Look, it's just a kind of, you know, 5 seconds, 10 seconds of stuff, but must have been as dangerous as hell to do, because if he timed it wrong, because the bike's going at a fair speed, if he timed it wrong and stuff, it would have, you know, it would have taken him out completely. So it was an absolutely brilliant, this jump back kick. It was a physicality of Donnie Yen we saw in this movie, which was great. And then you've got Michael Woods at the end, and you ramp it up with Michael Woods, and he's a big fella.
Boy, is he a big fella. And you don't. Both of them started wushu under Donnie's mother, I believe.
I don't know
anything about anything, but I don't necessarily associate like super big muscle guys doing like elegant wushu. But obviously, everyone can. But both of them, and especially Michael Woods, I think he's a standout in this movie. Both of them, you know, we talked about this on a prior thing, that when you, because I don't want to reveal it if it isn't released yet, when you bring in people that are good athletes in real life to Hong Kong action cinema, that could be the most amazing thing or the most frustrating thing. Because movie fighting is what it is. It's different. It's not athleticism like you know it. Both John and both Michael are incredible at responding to what's required of them.
And that's what was so good. Obviously, Donnie brought Michael in there, and all of a sudden you can see him in a few of his movies. He cropped up. But the fight scene, it's great. The way it comes across, and Yen Wu-Ping again delivers something different to that. And Donnie Yen himself said, you know, Yen Wuping would shout at Donnie, "More power, more power," and he was hitting Michael Woods, you know, and he more or less said any lesser guy, you know, he would have really hurt him, but Michael took it. Because Yen Wuping kept saying, "More power, more power. I want to see more power." You wanted to see it on the screen like it was like pow, pow, pow. You know, you could feel it. And you do. And you get that. That's come through. And that was all Yen Wuping going, "Oh, I want more. I want more. I want more." And they did. They really went for it in that scene. And you can see his arms are, you know, at one point are really red. When, you know, Donnie's really kicking him and they're having a go. But it's a great, great scene.
And Donnie is so tiny versus him. I love that contrast. And it's a test of strength too, that fight scene on the roof, which is also a fight scene you haven't seen earlier in the movie. So it isn't just like 10 minutes left. Well, I guess this scene is left. It's going to last a few minutes. Out in 10 minutes. Like, you're not distracted by anything else because Wuping adds different design. I'm also very grateful for the fact that they, you know, I don't think they had extensive experience in movies, right? So they're brought in, and especially when it comes to Michael Woods, they design a scene that he's capable of without having to do politically incorrect doubling. I didn't, you know, because that would have meant a Chinese person in a very poor wig and blackface, unfortunately. Yeah. But there's no such thing, because they, I want to think that they clearly looked at this in a way where both of these need to participate all the time and hard. And that's difficult, Phil.
Testament to them both. And this is like, and they're great. They're great scenes. They're both great scenes. Watch it just for the fight scene. If you're a fight fan, just watch it for those scenes. You can watch the whole film through because they're like, but those two scenes, it's like a prequel to when Yen Wuping went, "That's really good, but in actual fact, I'm going to make it even better." And then Tiger Cage 2, he brings them both back and they do it better, indifferent again, which is like, you know, again, he's unbelievable with, you know, swords and chains and all sorts. But, you know, he does it again and it's something different and stuff. But these guys, you know, like I say, they no stunt doubles. It's them. They're doing it. They're taking the hits and it comes across on screen so well.
It's a big risk. I mean, you don't want the structure of a conversation like, "I know two guys, they're my friends." They come and play Yen Wuping? And, you know, obviously they probably needed to demonstrate that they know something and that it can look good on film, but clearly it worked out so well. And it was so impressive to see these fights seem not be compromised by having doubling or having to slow it down because the performer wasn't a movie fighting performer, which you can't blame the performer for, obviously. But I'm so glad it worked out. It looks mightily impressive. Neither of them are asked to, they're quite silent presences as well. Because that makes it effective. So they don't place a lot of badly dubbed dialogue in their mouths, you know what I mean, to make the cheese factor increase or anything. No, they're quite silent assassins, which makes it all the more effective. Before we I conclude my notes, a late highlight is also Yun Yat Cho's final fight scene versus Cho Wing, which is the co-action director of the film. It's his second role in the film. He's a henchman in the Eddie Mayer scene, and then he turns up as this mightily fast and lethal assassin henchman versus Yun Yat Cho. And that's a really cool highlight as well. That guy can move, Cho Wing, and he makes it look lethal too. But yeah, he's in the movie twice. So
yeah, man, for them, fight scenes, great and stuff. Like I say, you know, again, it's a wonderful scene. But like I say, and that's the thing with this film. There's so many scenes that are just great from an action point of view. You don't really mind the plot being wafer thin as it is and stuff. It just drives you to the next scene, and you know, and that is what this film is all about. And it, you know, it's a great from an action point of view.
In all honesty, I never thought it was that the plot was wafer thin and a bothersome way. I think I would have if they had insisted on comedy in between. But here they kept the sort of dark momentum going from Seattle to Hong Kong. Ultimately, it's not an oppressing film where it's super, super dark and depressive, but I'm glad they kept an even mood throughout, even if the fight scenes seem more fun than lethal sometimes. Yeah, but there's a reason this movie is very liked, because it is a lot of fun, and it's over and done with quite quickly, and rewatchability factor is quite high. Granted, it's my second time in like 20 years, but that's my fault, obviously. but yeah, it was a lovely rewatch. So yeah, that's the end of my notes. So anything else you wanna say? Yeah, I mean, you're someone who chats to the stars. I mean, haven't you interviewed either John Salvini or Michael Woods throughout the years?
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was gonna say I have interviewed Michael, actually, because I was just about to say, because I asked him about Yen Wuping, and he was saying how smart he is. And what an excellent director. Not specifically about on In Line of Duty form and stuff, but interestingly on Tiger Cage, he was talking about they kind of choreographed that kind of on the go, which was like interesting. Interesting what they have to say and stuff. But yeah, I think it was about 9 years ago now that I interviewed Michael Woods. So yeah, brilliant fella. It was really nice of him to speak to him. So yes. I interviewed him, and you can find it on Eastern Film Fans. Lovely guy. And obviously worked on several of Donnie Yen's films on the back of obviously practicing Wushu. So yeah, he did all right for himself.
Yeah, even on some of those low budget Donnie Yen movies that you wouldn't think like are breakout material, like the Crystal Hunt and Cheetah on Fire and things like that, but hey, it's part of the journey, isn't it? So
yeah, it is, exactly.
Even, you know, heck, even Donnie did a Category 3 movie. Can you remember offhand which movie that would be?
No.
Holy Virgin versus the Evil Dead.
Oh, that was it.
That movie's got titties. Not Donnie's titties, but other titties.
Yes. Figures.
I hope I would have liked to love that movie more, but it's good fun, because you know, you really should watch a movie that's called Holy Virgin versus the Evil Dead, regardless of if it's good, any good or not.
Or not.
but yeah, that's Donnie's sort of supernatural romp with him versus Ken Lo, and then there's obviously some softcore scenes and some disrobing scenes from the ladies they cast, and boom. Category 3.
Woohoo!
So there it is. Yeah, so as for availability of In the Line of Duty 4, there's a couple of out of stock, but perhaps not fully out of print options out there. A Hong Kong Blu-ray was issued, but it looks to have remix options only, and I have no confirmation whether it's true high definition or a standard definition upscale. My guess is the latter, because it was issued so long ago that that was standard practice, unfortunately, back then. There was also a US DVD with remix options only as well, an older Hong Kong DVD remaster with optional mono, but I stuck to the Hong Kong Legends DVD that, despite a 5.1 Dolby remix, it really sounds and looks good. There's nothing added, really. Plus, it has a decent selection of extras, including an audio commentary with author Stefan Hammond and Michael Wong. And you would have thought, like, that commentary deserves a podcast on its own. Review the commentary. But no, I haven't listened to it. Reportedly, it's a bit of a dud. Mainly because there doesn't seem to be a lot of preparation by either party going in, and Stefan Hammond, true to his reputation, unfortunately, comments more on what's happening in the movie rather than talking about the production and asking Michael of his experience. Really, it could have been a nice interview piece, right?
Yeah.
But really, that's what it should have been too, like a filmed 15-20 minute interview with Michael. That would have been excellent as well. So I never really listened to it, because I've only heard so bad and mediocre things about the commentary. I mean, if he doesn't remember, that's fine. But if you're the moderator and the author of the commentary, you need to do your job and get as much out of the star as possible, rather than sitting there. There you are, walking up the stairs. Whoa, you're fighting now. Ooh, that hurt. Yes, it did. Excellent. Commentary money. So yeah, that DVD, by the way, seems to be the most readily available, the Hong Kong Legends DVD, and you can find it secondhand at reasonable prices. So go get it if you haven't. There's a Donnie Yen interview on there as well, but I don't know if it's an archive one that's more covering more general topics, or if it covers In the Line of Duty specifically. I actually did not have time to screen that interview, but it might be a general interview, sort of career overview up to that point when they did conduct that piece. But then, at any rate, we have one more movie to go in this bonus episode. So after the music break, fast forward to 1996. Michael Wong in the full Stone Wong mode, or SDU mode. And he started that image off in the Final Option. And he continues on with that image in First Option from 1996. And we'll be back after the music break to discuss that in this bonus episode. So sit tight and we'll be back. And welcome back in the second review in this website exclusive bonus episode only on podcastonfire.com. You can't find this particular show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher, or any other podcatchers. And in this exclusive chat, we're also going to take a look at First Option from 1996, starring Michael Wong, and plot from the Love HK film review of the film. Michael Wong plays Don Wong, an SDU captain. Despite psychiatric evaluations to the negative, he's the ideal leader for an SDU squad linked to the Customs Department as part of a special task force. Their mission? Apprehend nasty drug dealers led by the Ice Queen. Mike, he calls him Mike in the review, but I think he's referring to, he's referring to Michael Wong, but in some translations I think he's Mike Wong, but in the movie he is Don Wong, you can hear it. So Don is teamed with Jiggy Leung's Mimi Kwan, whose inexperience makes them clash. But despite those clashes, the two learn to understand each other, but not before things get bad. A sequel wouldn't be possible with the Stone Wong character from The Final Option. Draw your own conclusions what that means. But the waves that character made and Michael Wong's presence, that led to another idea instead. Let's make Wong into another Wong. Don Wong.
A bit of a coming up now. This is a Don Wong. I don't know. Go on. Love it.
I might have mentioned, I'm not too sure, but I might have mentioned in our episode on The Final Option that this movie, First Option, was a prequel. But regardless of if I did say it or not, it isn't. So I was potentially wrong. So that's needed to be stated. Because he is, it's obviously not Stone Wong's backstory, this or anything. It's a completely different different guy, looking the same. But what it still does is mixing action with the lives of the special duties unit characters, i.e. the cop soap opera was still viable to a degree. And this touches upon that, not as much as The Final Option. But what it also did was it outgrossed The Final Option, taking in a healthy 17 million Hong Kong dollars at the box office. It missed the top 10 spot that year, but it can't have been by much, since Young and Dangerous 3 at 19 million held the 10th spot. This was the year Jackie Chan's film, First Strike, took first place at the box office with a measly 57 million. followed by Stephen Chow's comedy, God of Cookery, with 40. And in third place, another Stephen Chow movie came in, Forbidden City Cop, with 36 million. And this is our special moment of this show. First Option had two nominations at the Hong Kong Film Awards, one for Best Editing and the other, despite not winning, a Best Actor nomination for Michael Wong. A good actor he was. A statuette he did not get. That's great. I'm not sure it's award-worthy, but it's great. It's an unusual nomination. I'm not saying it's bad, but I wouldn't have expected it. So it's very nice to see.
I totally agree with that statement. Yeah.
The other nominations, it was quite a packed category that year. They had 6 persons nominated. So the other nominations were Jackie Chan from First Strike, Leslie Cheung from Viva Erotica, Leon Lai from Comrades Almost a Love Story, Lau Ching Wan, Big Bullet, and Michael Wong, First Option. But the winner, and deservedly so, was a co-star of Michael Wong's from another movie, Kent Cheng won Best Actor at the Hong Kong Film Awards for his performance in the actually excellent movie that we didn't pick for the coverage called The Log. It's quite a good thriller drama, and it's the one where Michael Wong has quite a slicked back hair, dude, looking all cool and great. But Ken Cheng is
that why you didn't pick it?
Yeah, it's out. It's not. Yeah. It's not acceptable. But it's very it's a very good and affecting cop drama. But that's Ken Chiang's movie, really. I was very happy to see him win that. So good old veteran Ken Chiang from Once Upon a Time in China, playing Butcher Wing, and just a ton of other movies. One of Hong Kong's greatest character actors. As for my short opinion on First Option, this is my first time seeing it. This is a very well-mounted and professional production. There's some attention to character, but it also doesn't venture too much out of its action perimeters. So it isn't trying to rewrite the STU action movie game. But I appreciated the character moments we get. I was more than pleased with the professional action beats. It's quite exciting. It's also a better STU movie than Final Option. You know, the training movie was fine. But now we get a serious big boy movie where there's no training, there's just consequences and action and danger to a degree. So I found it quite entertaining. And Michael is also growing in comfort in this role. It is the better SDU role out of these two, if you want to compare these two. But yeah, it was cool that he got as far as best actor at the Hong Kong Film Awards. So there you go. Maybe they nominated him for speaking English very, very well, which he does. So hurrah, I won. So what did you think of First Option?
Yeah, more or less the same. It's one of those films that actually grew on me as well. So it took me a time, although I do like Michael's character, and you can see, you know, he's got more depth to it in this. And again, Michael suited to this role as well, I think. So that helps. But the film itself, yeah, I warmed up to it. So by the end, obviously, it was great, and I was there with it. But it did take some warming up. And I don't know whether that's maybe what I discussed with the leads, and not necessarily Michael in it, took more time to come around. But as an action film, set piece wise, yeah, it's a solid film.
And it's actually still Gordon Chan that's directing the Option movies, and in between he. He logged two quite notable movies. I think one is considered a classic. One is Divisive. Gordon directed Fist of Legend, the remake of Fist of Fury, which is sort of universally hailed as quite a distinguished remake of Fist of Fury. It's actually so much better in character areas. If you think back on the role that Yasuaki Kurata has in Fist of Legend, it's nuanced versus Fist of Fury. That's, you know, Chinese good, Japanese bad, kill, kill, kill. You know, it's the lay of the land when it came to 70s Hong Kong martial arts cinema. It's great, Fist of Fury, but you can't say it has nuanced depictions of the Japanese characters in that one. And Gordon was also the main director for Thunderbolt, but I think there was an unofficial multi-directing team on the maddeningly all over the place but widely entertaining Thunderbolt with Jackie Chan. It's like three or four movies in one, including a Kirk Wong Ringo Lam movie with the shootout in the police station and martial arts at the arcade and racing and that wild like where they destroy the container home with Jackie Chan's family. That's really distressing. It's a mess, but I like Thunderbolt. It's so much
you
fun.
You do. You have got a soft spot. This isn't the first time you mentioned Thunderbolt and stuff. You've got some kind of fetish going on with it, I'm sure, Ken, to be honest. But yeah, fair play. It is fun.
You don't associate that kind of violence with a Jackie Chan movie in the 90s. No. You know what I mean? That police shootout with Michael Wong, who was in that and equips himself well in those action scenes. But there are a lot of cooks in that filmmaking kitchen, let's just say. But the racing aspect is kind of the worst in Thunderbolt. With they ran into trouble and they couldn't have the cars go at a certain miles per hour and had to toy with the film speed afterwards, and that looks pretty bad on the movie, to be honest. But and Jackie was injured as well, so there's a lot of doubling in that film. But wildly entertaining, I think. And my favorite Jackie Chan theme song, I think that's a rocking tune, whatever it's called. The Thunderbolt song. It's a really peppy number.
Sidebar. Why haven't they brought Thunderbolt and done a big release on that? I'm surprised. I've seen, you know, lots of these films, but that one, again, hasn't really been. Accidental Spy hasn't been.
Accidental Spy has been reissued, but Thunderbolt, I think, has good enough DVDs out there, but not a Blu-ray as such. But Accidental Spy was reissued on Blu-ray, actually.
Yeah, yeah, but Thunderbolt would be interesting. I mean, it's Jackie Chan, I'm surprised. Somebody must have it somewhere, I guess, locked in the lockdown.
Or we'll get it announced next week as these Hong Kong reissues
Yeah, left, right, and centre. That's very true, exactly. Which, you know, I can't grumble off. Thank you very much, everybody, for doing this. It's wonderful to get reissues of our favourites. So I love it.
Yeah. Some of my favourite softcore pornographic movies from Hong Kong are getting these deluxe reissues. So I'm a happy man.
Exactly.
One of the action designs here in First Option, it's something I latched onto, is that Gordon Chan and his action team decide to do a lot of close quarter dangerous action scenes, whether outside or inside, but mainly inside. So I personally really like that stylish choice, as the customs raid happens and there's both grenade and automatic gunfire in these tight environments as Jiggy Leung and her team are sort of shut out of this, and the SDU team take charge. It's before Michael enters, but I think it's a stylistic sort of statement and something Gordon Chan continues throughout the film, that the danger and the atmosphere in these tight, dark, very unpredictable situations is something that really stuck with me. Meant therefore that the action scene design didn't need to be flashy as such. So I was wondering if you had any general take on that, in the way he designs action, if you look at that customs raid at the beginning and the variety of room breaches that they do throughout the movie.
You can see they've done the homework. You can see that it made it realistic, and they've done it. You know, you could have done it in kind of a comic book style, so to speak, but it isn't. It looks realistic. It looks like, you know, if a team were going to go in, that's what they'd be doing. That's what it looks like. The close quarters brings that and brings the viewer into that on what they're trying to do as an SDU unit. And I think that just shows the preparation and what they did and the understanding and probably the team they had around them. Obviously, Bruce Law bringing what he did to it and understanding, but also I think bringing in a team of people to work with them, so it did look realistic, and that set the bar then for the rest of the film, to make it look like it was real and bring the viewer in that close quarters.
Yeah, I really thought it was done with clarity as well. It's not like Gordon Chan flings his camera about the place and tries to create chaos that way. I thought it was a very nice sense of clarity and dangerous, you know, they throw flashbangs in there and they take up subjects that they should in bloody fashion as well. So it's not playing nice necessarily. So really like that design choice. It sets a tone for the movie, as does Michael's introduction. One aspect that they I mean, his first scene, he has apparently crashed his car because he's drinking a lot, but they never touch on his drinking problem again. They just touch on the fact that he's a little bit rattled psychologically, but he dusts himself off and takes a policeman's bike and rides it off in a pouring rain. Doesn't wear a helmet. He's a man's man, damn it. And he's off and running to his adventure as the SDU team leader. Do you think, I mean, we touched on it, but here are some more details, I suppose. Is he suited and sort of even destined to play this leader? I mean, is it like a mixture of charisma, physical presence? Because he's not as scrawny anymore as he was in the 80s.
He's grown up, hasn't he? Well done. You've grown up. You turn into this man, this guy, and he looks the part. He looks like if you were, you know, going to be part of this kind of SWAT team, that's what you'd look. He just suits the role. It's just like he did. I am born for a role, but you know, he suits it. I think that's obvious in the fact that the number of spin-offs there was on it going forward, the series of films and stuff. He was great. He found a niche for him where he looked good, you know, he acted well, he obviously enjoyed that, doing those kind of roles, and it works for him, and it works here, and there's enough there that he can, you know, can give the guts, so as it were, and on screen and stuff, and he doesn't come off as being cheesy or corny in any way. So yeah, he'd grown up and grown in, and this was kind of, I think, his role.
Very much so, and I think he commands his unit very well, and he's also surrounded with bit players acting as immersive character actors, whether ones we really know, like Damien Lau, but he also has a right-hand man that was called, in the movie, Joe Chung, in the real life is called Joseph Chung. But, you know, the somewhat elderly right-hand man that is with him all the time, that's looks like the one that's probably mainly training the team. You know, he takes orders from Don Wong. I mean, they had a little good interaction throughout the movie. So he, Gordon Chan, surrounds him with those that skill set. And I never thought the tropes were disruptive for the movie either. It's a problematic police officer. It's not cleared psychologically. Apparently a drinking problem, as the first scene shows, but he got over that while riding in the rain. Like, I'm not doing that anymore. And even, you know, there's a lot of dialogue scenes in the headquarters that they built for themselves, and Gordon Chan's camera sort of nicely floats with the dialogue that happens back and forth. The sync sound, thankfully. I suppose the elements that do not quite gel, it's decent enough writing, but the issue of women not participating in this and women trying to find their place in this team effort, the writing is pretty decent, I suppose, within an action perimeter. Michael comes off as judgmental, quite protective, but in a little bit of condescending way towards Jiggy Leung. I didn't think they expanded enough on that aspect of the script to make her come to life and her assertive nature come to life. It seems like she grew a little bit. She got experience, but they don't expand a lot on the fact that you know, men and women and departments need to work together. They touch upon that, but don't expand enough on it for my taste. And I think a problem also lies with the fact I don't think Jiggy Leung is commanding this role as well as it should be commanded. I mean, she's inexperienced, looks a little bit fragile and rattled, but she's a little bit out of her element even as an actress for this role. She's at times she's almost there. She matches that character, but he is kind of outdoing her in the sort of presence department, and I never thought it was necessarily memorable, their clash together.
Yeah, and that was my problem with the movie, hence why it took me a time to warm to it, because she detracted from it, because Michael was really good in it. But Gigi just wasn't, she didn't have the presence, as you say, to hold that. So when she did come on screen, it wasn't nothing there. I mean, she looks great, bless her, but, you know, there wasn't the depth of character there that she brought. And like I say, she almost did it at times and stuff, and you kind of, by the end of the film, kind of warmed to it, because I really love the character and what Michael brings, etc. And, you know, kind of drove the film to a certain extent, but I like the presence of it anyway and what Gordon had done. But Gigi just didn't quite step up to the plate. It was a little bit, maybe not the right person for that role. So like I say, there was that, that's where I was coming from, in the fact that it took me a while to warm up to the movie from that point of view.
I think there it's underwritten. It's a problem. Mm. I think she is almost there, as I said, but I think it's underwritten and needed a few more beats to make her place felt and her purpose a little bit more felt. They have some good, not off-hours scenes together, but a couple of little dialogue exchanges as well. There's nothing going on for a minute, where they have some nice chemistry, Michael and Jiggy, but that's not the design of the movie either, for them to be the romantic item. It's not even designed like that. But, you know, you have a moment or two where you sort of chat, and it's lighthearted for a minute at the very least, and that looked good on both of them. I think she's very cute, and he's uber handsome, as we all know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they look good as a couple of standing side by side. It's just when she speaks, we're in trouble, bless her, so a little bit.
I think also, since we're pre-handover, I suppose it's the logical reason that an instructor like Michael would speak English. We know as a performer, he's comfortable mixing Cantonese and English, and his team would understand his, you know, long sentences and tirades and briefings in English, not just a brief jargon between during breaches and what have you. So there's no ill logic with him speaking tons of English and everybody saying like yes, or saying tons of sentences in Cantonese back to him. So I think that makes sense because we're pre-hand over. And but he isn't a playful Stone Wong. If you remember Stone Wong as an instructor, he's a little bit of slight goofball. You know, he liked to have fun with his cadets as they were doing push-ups, like 47, 45, 49, 40. Keep going. You haven't reached 50 yet. So, but that fury, that edge to him, while he's never going to be this breakout actor, he isn't terribly bad at channeling that fury and that edge to him, because I think it comes down to comfort in the role, comfort in that leader role, and it's the physical presence too. If he wasn't super scrawny, but he certainly over a decade grew in size, you know, added some bulk to him, and that for some reason, I mean, it sounds very daft, I suppose, adds a little bit of presence, a little bit of edge to him, like and a physical need that the character needs to have. I don't think 1986's Michael Wong would have been suitable for a Don Wong. It would just look like, who is that tiny guy yelling orders?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I said. He grew into it, didn't he? You could see that kind of role was ideal for him because it was the right time and the right time for it. And looking back, it is strange he was nominated, I guess. But you probably could see it probably that, you know, he fitted that role and for some reason I think the public enjoyed that, therefore I think there was a buzz around it.
It was certainly audience friendly. 17 million is nothing to scoff at. That's what I mean.
And probably all the sticky they did get previous, you know, it was something that actually people actually went, oh, I actually enjoyed Michael Wong. You enjoyed Michael Wong? And then somebody would watch it and go, actually, I enjoyed him in that. And probably the buzz from that was enough. And, you know, on the back of it, it probably did get a nomination. And maybe it was deserved. I'm still shocked by it, but maybe it was deserved. I'm glad Kent won. But, you know, and that's just testament to he is strong in that role in this film, and he does drive the film. And what we're saying, Michael Wong is driving the film. Yeah, he is. He's driving this film.
Some further action beats that I think are really exciting. Again, Gordon Chan working with Bruce Law handling this. I think he's got nice control over the excitement. Like, for instance, in the middle of the movie when the SDU team, who are about to breach the area that the Thai weapons dealers or drug dealers are hiding in, there's a team that's already ahead of them. Rogue team. And I think that's really exciting, that where everything goes wrong at the same time. That obviously leads to the sequence where some of his team die. They stumble over that landmine, claymore or landmine. While there is this exaggerated shot of Michael like being all rattled psychologically when he sees death around him, they don't linger on that too much. So the sequence really comes out as a winning sequence. So this action is obviously not designed by Bruce Law to be stylish or bloodshed. It's to the point. It's violent and it's exciting that when the raid goes wrong, that when that unknown team beats them to the ties, and it's even lacking a score for a majority of it. I noticed that as that sequence and twist came upon us. Like, there's no music driving this. It's a very well-driven sequence regardless. It's a bit of a risky venture. And, you know, when they are a step behind and having to deal with snipers in that tight grass area, in that woodland area, that sequence just escalates and goes, you know, increasingly wrong. And I think it's a standout sequence for the general excitement, but for design as well, it can't be easy to stage something that isn't coming with this stylish flair a la John Woo or anything. Like their choice must still be quite difficult, because it also needs to adhere to, as you said, a certain realism rather than like improvised SDU tactical stuff. I think it's reckless to eject realism altogether. I'm sure they had to eject some realism for the sake of the movie, but it's probably SDU people who know these tactics. I hope they respected some of what they pulled off here in terms of that. But
yeah, I think so. Other thing, like you say, then they started it really well at the start of the movie by doing that, and then just carried that through. And I think Bruce Lord did say on the film they had, they brought people in, and some of the extras in it were actually, you know, military. They were, you know, they knew about this, so they always had them on set to advise, etc. So you get that realism from the research and obviously what Gordon brought in from a production team to support it. So, yeah.
Is it right or fair to say that it's when that twist happens, if you even like that sequence, is it gripping the way it goes wrong in such an extensive way for the team, because then it motivates them to
that's fight back. And then that's what all of a sudden, as I said, the film grew on me. That was one of the reasons why it grew on me, because of all of a sudden you had this twist in it. I was like, oh, okay, hold on a second, there's something new. Oh, that's gone. I didn't see that one coming. Well, I probably did, but it's good. There's a fresh element to it. There's something else to think about. They've driven the plot and the storyline to, you know, something else now. And okay, this is quite interesting. So yeah, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the way that, you know, they changed it up, and all of a sudden you've got this foreign kind of hit team, or, you know, treasure hunting team, that all of a sudden they're, you know, Michael Wong's kind of becomes a nemesis, and then all of a sudden, like, okay, this is going to get interesting. You know, it's another layer on top of that you want to see. So yeah, that was good.
The only thing they, I mean, it's fine, but you could read Richard Gross's part in this from a mile off. The Don Wong's friend, like, I don't think he's a good guy.
I don't think he's gonna be.
He's kind of smarmy. He's kind of like, he didn't chew gum, but it's more like, yeah, sup, yeah.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But to be honest, the Westerners were great in this, weren't they?
Cause better than average for Hong Kong movies,
yeah,
that's for
but,
sure.
Well, they say above average, but, you know, compared to what...
I wouldn't say great, Phil, but they're better than average for Hong Kong
movies.
Yeah,
they are better than average, come on. But let's face it, some of the stuff we've seen and stuff, like, they're just poor. They're just... But considering they're in it for the time that they are, and there's, you know, big... large segments, they're not bad. They are above average, shall we say, then. But yeah, I like that.
It's pretty decent up until the introduction of the entire rogue team. it was entertaining, though. But when they introduce all those, that rogue gang, they're tough, they're big, muscle guy, they're overacting guys who get giddy about money. Woo! Yes! Money, rich! it's genre appropriate, though, but I thought they've directed it, they've cast them and directed them for maximum overacting, and that's what they did. So Richard Gross is like underplayed, and he looks like a professional to a degree. Richard Gross isn't this random pick from the streets, and the other guys, I'm sure they cast by looking at him to some degree, you know, rather than picking them up from like, you have muscles, you'll be in the movie. Like, I don't think it was that random. Back in the day, that was probably the case, you know. Looking for appropriate looking Westerners at hostels and things like that. So, but by that point, yeah, they have dipped into a little bit of personal drama. Like, we get exposition into Don Wong's life via the many answering machine messages that he has on his machine as he comes home, which is a decent way of getting exposition in there. And there's actually a very good speech, I thought, by Michael. Maybe that's what got him nominated. When the SDU team are at their lowest, he has a very good speech about all the manpower and planning in the world could still mean failure. You're not invincible Superman.
Yeah.
But... you know, even if you crack under pressure, doesn't mean that you're not suited for the jobs. We're human, but we need to pick ourselves up, though. And some of that English delivery is some of the most assured I've heard Michael do. So even when he does speak English, it's not. It's someone reading off the script rather than believing in what they're saying. Here he's in a little bit more in tune with a key moment like that, and I think that moment can stand as a very likable moment and motivational moment for the audience too. So let's transition into the big final action scene, and let's see the payback. And it wasn't bad, and so it attempts some drama, some nuance, and that classic action movie trope of the big speech, but I thought it looked good on Michael, because it's not bad writing. It's sort of correct. He isn't disappointed in them because that was not something they counted on. You can't counter such odds being presented before you that quickly. As that sequence was, you know, with hidden snipers and booby traps and all of that. So maybe that was his Hong Kong Film Awards clip during the televised ceremony. You know?
It could have been. Yeah, it could have been. You never know.
You know, if you remember first, Final Option, it did deal a little bit more with the off hours and the drama and things like that. But I didn't miss it in this movie because this movie was concerned with this scenario. But the little dips into their personal lives, yeah, okay, I know a little bit, but I don't necessarily need 20 minutes of the off hours drama. It's okay to stay in the headquarters and the action scenarios and get us in under 90 minutes for that. So I thought, like, decent insights, but I prefer the action beats, to be honest.
Yeah, but by the time the end comes, it's one of those films that I'd watch again. So that is always testament that I'd watch it again and pick things up. And it's not overly, well, certainly at the end of the film, if you look at it from a violent, you know, bloodthirsty, there's a couple of nice little shots in there, literally, one to the head, which is quite nice. But there isn't an excessive amount of, you know, blood and guts everywhere, considering the amount of, obviously, you know, people that are shooting, etc. But it is a nice, it's a nice healthy ending and shootout, which is a nice payoff for the end of the film, which I quite enjoyed.
It's one final thing that needs to be mentioned, I suppose. I don't know who thought of this or who wrote this, but it's there, and you either use it as enjoyment or you're taken out of the film for some reason when Michael is reflecting on when he talks of the betrayal of his friend, and he starts quoting Yoda.
Oh, yes.
And it's out of the blue, and it's dealt with in a couple of seconds, and you went, go like, what? Why did he say, seduced by the dark side he was? A good heart he had. Like, Michael, what are you... Correct your words. Put him in the right order.
Doing his best Yoda impression.
It wasn't even an impression, man. He was just talking.
It was, yeah. It wasn't even an impression. He was just talking. I don't know why.
Misa, it's the you member. I think, why, if it would have been made afterwards, like
it was, and that's probably why he didn't win the award, to be honest, because they just saw that and went, oh my god, no. No.
I mean, thankfully, it's like the last minute of the movie, so it's not like, oh, we got to deal with 20 more minutes after that.
Exactly.
It's very odd. It's very odd because it's not done with so he's not winking at us when no one is winking at us when a good heart he had, seduced by the dark side he was. Oh, Star Wars. Great. Fine. Okay. The end. So I am satisfied, but what the heck?
Yeah, what the bloody hell was that? Yeah. But there was a little bit of that, wasn't there?
I mean, if he got famous for his Don't Call Me Guaylo from Final Option, which is a pretty fun line, a great line.
Yeah, exactly.
For this movie, it's that line, but I think it induces more snicker than actual, like, cool. You're into a culture, man. Gordon Chan and his writer, they're into Star Wars culture. No, it's kind of dumb.
Yeah, it was a little bit silly. They just didn't need to do that. Fortunately, like I say, the film was over, so it was done with. But it was like you were contemplating afterwards. Did he just really say that? Did he really?
I mean, Yoda was the shit. I mean, he said great things. But yeah. it's not applicable to an SDU movie.
Not this movie in any way, shape, or form. Should it be in this movie?
So it's like I was thinking when I watched it, because it had not happened yet, right? So I was thinking, was this the movie with the Star Wars dialogue?
And then, with a
minute left, oh yeah, it was, and there it was.
There it is, boom! Oh God Almighty!
Like, imagine if he would have said that during the first breach or anything. Man, remember, a good heart you have, seduced by the dark side, you can't be. Now go in and get the Thai people. Get the ice cream. Like, exactly. Imagine if that would have happened like minute one. Like, oh dear, no. You didn't, but no, that's amusing. Kudos, by the way, to the DVD. I had not seen this done yet. I'm a billion years old, Phil, so I need subtitles for everything. And when I had the subtitle track, the default English subtitle track on, which only translated the Cantonese dialogue, and then like 30 minutes in, wait a minute, there was like a hard of hearing track on as well. And that one translated everything, including the English dialogue. Michael's, I had no problem hearing. I had a little bit of trouble hearing Roger Gross's dialogue. And thankfully, the DVD had like the second subtitle track where you got help with that. So not all DVDs do that. And no, I was very pleased to see. I don't know how it was on the original cinema print, if they subtitled all dialogue. I hope they did. But that was a nice touch for a UK DVD, if you need subtitles for the quite vast amount of English dialogue that's here. So the end of my notes. I was pleased. I think, do we need more SDU, like big SDU movies? I think the spin-offs you're talking of are like direct-to-video movies and a bit cheaper productions. But it would have been nice to get like another Gordon Chan and Michael Wong joint in 1998 or whatever. But hey, in 1998, Beast Cops happened instead. So I suppose that's and Best Picture history was made. So they did get together, but it wasn't that type of SDU movie. So
I think for me, the only thing was, Bruce Law saying, must have been impressed off, because in an interview he did say that Michael Wong did, they got some stuntmen in when he's climbing up the by the billboards and stuff, and they had stuntmen ready, and Michael Wong just did it. They hooked him up and did it. And obviously the use of camera angles makes it look more than it is. But Michael Wong, again, prepared to do some of the stunt work that they got stunt people in for. And again, I think that always goes well down well and stuff if the actors are prepared to do some of the stunts. And, you know, we've seen Michael do that before and stuff. And again, obviously he was front and center to do what he could on this movie as well. So I think that was good. And that showed, obviously, again, realism with the film. But again, like I say, I suppose I think, yeah, you know, it's one of those films that, you know, I'd definitely watch again. There's enough there to warrant, you know, another viewing. So, yeah, it was definitely solid by Michael.
And as for availability of First Option, it had two local Hong Kong DVD releases, one from the cinema print, like a probably, you know, reused the Laserdisc transfer in the early days of DVD. That was quite common. Latter was a better quality reissue, but both of them looks to be out of print. For extras and for the sake of availability, the UK release by Hong Kong Legends comes recommended, though somewhat pricey, but nothing. Think prices in the early 2000s, you know, and apply. I think I paid like £20 plus shipping for mine, and it's a little bit expensive for a used DVD, but it's fine. But it has interviews with, as Phil mentioned, with action director Bruce Law, with actress Jiggy Leung for the DVD, and an audio commentary with Bay Logan and Mike Leader, which I didn't have time to listen to. So that's that. So knowing Hong Kong reissues on Blu-ray, seeing both the option films on Blu-ray in 2021 is not out of the realms of possibility. So if you can't find the DVD, then sit tight. There might be some HD upgrades for the Stone Wong, Don Wong double bill that you can then have at home, in the comforts of your home.
In the comforts of your home. And why not?
And you can hear and see the Star Wars dialogue in front of you in HD and still be baffled why it's even there.
Let's not detract. Let's not concentrate on that. Don't concentrate on that. It is now. Now I've said it. People are going to concentrate on that. In fact, people are going to buy it just so they can see that end scene with that dialogue in, aren't they? So that's done it.
Well, we are done for this bonus episode. But we're gonna do a third movie. I mean, we can do endless amounts of movies. We can do Your Birthday Cake, the Wong Jing production. I don't know if he directed it, where Michael Wong plays quite a flamboyantly gay character. And at one point he says in English, "There are no women that can make me hard." And then Ching Miao makes him hard. Yep, It's that kind of movie. He can change us in that. But we might save that for just regular coverage when we feel like it. But no.
It's just, yeah, just random
watching. I mean, there's more. Well, why
not? Yeah.
But the final Michael Wong movie we're going to review in this run, in this bonus episode run that extends our main coverage, is, as I said, a daft little movie called Whatever You Want by Wong Jing. I had no idea what to expect from it when I watched it. Oh, Michael Wong is a genie in a bottle, and Anita Jung gets to make wishes, I suppose. And then I watched it, and I was like, this is my favorite movie of all time. I mean, it's hysterical. For me, it was hysterical. And Michael Wong as the genie in the bottle, and Wong Jing just having a ball and being very silly. And that's what I'm going to... I know Phil is kind of like, a genie can... I'd rather have Star Wars dialogue throughout an entire movie, but... It's hysterical. For me, it was hysterical. And it syncs sound as well. Virginia speaks English and Anita Yun doesn't. So
I'm gonna look forward to this. I'm not saying it, so it'll be a new one for me. So it should be interesting.
It's one of those, it's released as a Shaw Brothers DVD because it's the TVB production company, Cosmopolitan. TVB was formed by Shaw Brothers. Therefore, when all rights were gathered up, that meant these Cosmopolitan productions became like part of the Celestial library and therefore got reissues on DVD under the Shaw Brothers banner, if you will. So that's why you have like several Stephen Chow movies as Shaw Brothers DVDs, like Love on Delivery and Mad Monk, because they were produced by Cosmopolitan, and that includes Whatever You Want. This is kind of neat. Even those Andy Lau movies, Casino Tycoon 1 and 2, and that we got on UK Blu-ray, they were also part of that production. So, and therefore, were kept in circulation. So that's good. So that's what we're doing in the next bonus episode as a final pin in it for now. But I'm your birthday cake. I'm going to try and warm up Phil to the genius of that movie. I don't remember liking it that much, but Michael Wong's dialogue and playing a very flamboyant character was memorable, to say the least. So you can do it all, folks. But we're off. Thank you, everybody, for sticking with us in this bonus episode format, website-exclusive bonus episode. You followed us to the website from the podcast feeds to this. We're very grateful. Hope you enjoy the next episode, and we're off for now. So see you. I've been Kenny B, and with me was Phil G. So say goodbye to the kids.
Take care. Be well, folks.